You are listening to The Trend here on WNIN. I'm your host, Cass Harrington. And before we dive into the conversation about happiness on this dreary Friday afternoon, here's your local and regional news. Indiana's unemployment rate has dropped below 8% for the first time since November 2008, according to the October unemployment report. The drop represents the biggest three-month drop in 20 years, according to the Indiana Department of Workforce Development. Evansville Vanderburg School Board attorney Pat Shoulders says several board members have said they want to fill Board President Sally Becker's soon-to-be-vacant seat as soon as possible. Since only 1 year remains on her term, members want the new appointee to have as much time as possible to become familiar with the role, Shoulders says. The Evansville School Board will discuss selecting a person Monday evening to fill the vacancy on the seven-member board caused by Becker's end-of-the-year resignation. Anyone interested in serving the remaining year of Becker's term, which extends through December 2014, must apply by noon on Monday. Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear has announced more than $1.1 million to develop and maintain 20 trail projects throughout the state. Beshear says opening trails is key to expanding adventure tourism, allowing communities to attract tourists while also providing outdoor activities for local residents. The money can be used to purchase easements or develop and maintain trails for a range of activities from hiking to riding horses, motorcycles, and all-terrain vehicles. The money comes from the Federal Highway Administration and is administered by the Kentucky Department for Local Government. Leaders of all four legislative caucuses say a renewed effort at providing greater access to early childhood education will be one of the top priorities in the upcoming session. Last session, House Republicans pushed a significant preschool pilot program, providing money to send 1,000 children to preschool. Senate Republicans dramatically scaled it back, citing concerns about cost. But for the upcoming session, legislative leaders in both parties are renewing the focus on early childhood ed. Senate Minority Leader Tim Lanning says providing greater access to preschool helps tackle some of the state's economic challenges. The Trend covered early childhood education on a program in August, and you can listen to that on the Trends page at WNIN.org. Speaking of recent Trend conversations, on last week's program, we talked about access to local food. And it turns out Central Indiana farmers will soon have thousands of new hungry customers, local public school students. The U.S. Department of Agriculture awarded Indiana a $100,000 grant this week to establish a program that gets more local food in public schools. The program will connect Indiana farmers and school corporations through an Indiana food hub called the Hoosier Harvest Network, an aggregate of 27 producers from as far north as Fort Wayne to as far south as Batesville. That's your local and regional news. Stay with us after this quick break for The Trend.
You're listening to The Trend on 88.3 WNIN and online at WNIN.org. Support today comes from Evansville Day School, partnering with parents to offer a student-centered education program for students junior pre-kindergarten through 12th grade. More information at evansvilledayschool.org or at 812-476-3039. People seem to be
Support for The Trend comes from members of the local programming fund. I'm Cass Harrington, and on today's program, we are talking about happiness in the tri-state. It may sound a little cheesy, but it turns out happiness is a term used in business and economic circles, and it has a lot to do with what's going on, particularly here in Evansville. First up, we have an interview that's laying the groundwork for today's conversation. I spoke with Johannes Harada, a visiting professor of economics at the University of Southern Indiana. He's from Osnabrück, Germany, and he's traveled around the world looking at different populations and how varying degrees of economic development relate to happiness. Let's listen to my interview with Johannes Harada. I'm here with Johannes Hirata. He is a visiting professor of economics from USI's partner school in Osnabrück, Germany. And right now he's teaching a few international economics classes. And I brought him in the studio today because he has a very interesting take on happiness and correlation to development or even income, perhaps. But we'll get into that a little later. First of all, Johannes, thank you for being on the program.
It's my pleasure.
And before we dive into your research and possible links between development and happiness around the world, maybe we should take a step back and define happiness, because rarely do we see happiness in economic studies. It's more philosophical or psychological. So in terms of economics, how are you defining happiness?
Right. So happiness is, of course, a very old concept, and economists cannot claim to be, you know, the first to have discovered it, and nor do they have a very original take on it. But what they are actually doing is looking into an empirical concept of happiness, which is more precisely called subjective well-being. So I don't really have a definition of happiness, because what I prefer to do is look into how people use the idea and the term happiness, and then derive just by, you know, observing the use of language, what people understand by happiness, the way they use it. So this will be different for different language communities, and this will change over time as well. And it's really the domain, I think, of philosophers and philosophers of language to, you know, give us a definition. I also think a definition is not so crucial, because everybody has a pretty clear understanding. And though there may be, you know, minor differences in my understanding and your understanding, it will overlap like 99%.
Really, that much?
That's what I think. I mean, I think, you know, when I give you an example of a person, I describe a person to you, and you think that person must be happy, then almost everybody will agree, yeah, that seems to be a happy person. And I can show some weird examples of where we disagree. But so I think this common sense notion gets us a really long way into thinking and talking about happiness.
So when you talk about happiness in its empirical form, you refer to it as subjective well-being, correct?
Right.
And you're saying that across cultures, there may be a different way of expressing it through language?
Well, across different languages and cultures, the idea may be different. So the word we use, when you translate it from English to German or any other language, people will use those words in probably slightly different ways, or sometimes pretty substantially different ways. So this means we must be careful when comparing, for example, the subjective well-being of countries. Mm-hmm. So, and the empirical concept of subjective well-being is actually pretty easily defined as what people answer to those questions they are asked in those surveys, which, for example, go like, considering your life as a whole, how happy are you on a scale from, for example, 1 to 10?
I see. And that brings up an interesting question, too, because happiness isn't necessarily a stagnant thing for some people. Sometimes it fluctuates and changes maybe what's going on with the economy, or maybe in their own lives if a loved one passes away. So how are you able to gauge happiness when your life is a high and a low?
Right. That is actually one of the points that are debated in the literature, whether people have a set point of happiness, so whether they're kind of average level of happiness is determined and they always return to that level. That's called set point theory. And the other view is that it's the events of your life that actually do have a lasting influence on your happiness. In my interpretation, the evidence is clearly that personality has an influence, but it's not a fate that you have just, you know, because you have a certain genetic disposition or an upbringing that it means you can never, you know, get beyond 6 on the 10-point scale. And certain events definitely have a lasting impact. And some of these are, well, getting married in most cases has a positive influence. Unfortunately, often too often it also has a negative influence. Mm-hmm. But losing your job is definitely devastating for most people, and also in the long term. So people do not really get used to that.
So what exactly are the main predictors of someone's happiness?
Yeah, so the first is what psychologists call personality. And, well, personality itself seems to depend to a substantial degree on genetics. So when you observe twins, even if they are raised apart, they share a lot of common personality features, and therefore also their level, the degree of happiness will be pretty similar, even if their life circumstances are different. But then personality also has to do with, you know, your experiences in childhood and culture. When you just want to guess how happy a certain person is, and you just know the type of personality on the metrics that psychologists use, you already have a pretty good chance of getting it roughly right, even without knowing anything about other aspects of that person's life. The other aspects or variables that researchers try to use to predict a person's happiness are far less important. So, for example, demographics like age or gender play a minor role, and then income also comes in, but it also seems to play a minor role. So when you know a person's income, well, you can make a guess about, you know, that people with a relatively higher income score higher on those scales, but often you will be wrong about that.
That's where discussions about the correlation between income and economic growth and happiness, there was kind of a surge in that interest in the 90s.
Right.
Starting with Easterlin's research, right?
That's right.
Is that where your interest lied when you were studying as a master's student and a PhD?
Yes, definitely. So this article that you mentioned by Richard Easterlin from UCLA was from 1974, and he had very few data at his disposal, but he made some inferences from the data that he had. And then in the 90s, economists looked back at that and saw that they had much better data, and that's what caught my attention. And so most of this was trying to understand the relationship between happiness and income, because there was already quite some, you know, literature and good studies that at least gave a somewhat clear pattern on this relationship. My interest was really, what does this mean now for economics, so economic theory, but also economic policy?
You're listening to The Trend on 88.3 FM. Still ahead, host Cass Harrington will be sitting down with the director of the Department of Metropolitan Development and asking him about his awesome title. He'll also explain why he thinks an IU medical school downtown will increase happiness in Evansville. And we'll also hear more of our conversation with economist Johannes Herrada. That's all coming up as The Trend continues. Support for the program comes from Tin Man Brewing Company, announcing their locally brewed beer varieties in cans and on draft, now available in local stores and locations. More information available at tinmanbrewing.com.
And what sort of patterns are you seeing? I know there's a strong sense of happiness in, you know, United States or Western Europe, where there's a greater economic stability. But yeah, what other sorts of patterns have you recognized?
Yeah, that's the first pattern that is pretty clear, that when you look at different countries and compare their level of happiness, then it's true that among the wealthier countries, like the United States or most Western European countries, or also Japan, South Korea, and others, there are no unhappy countries. So all of them are pretty rather high, even though there's a lot of variation. If you look at all the unhappy countries, all of them are poor then, obviously. But among the poor countries, you do find some that are as happy as the United States and other rich countries, even though they are the exception, but they are still, I think, interesting enough to look at.
Like, one interesting exception is Bhutan and their
right
gross national happiness.
Exactly. So Bhutan is an interesting case, not because they're the happiest countries on earth, they are not, but because they have decided to make that the idea of happiness a kind of, well, state philosophy. There was a decision or a step that the former king in the 70s did by saying that gross national happiness is more important to us than gross national product. And so in Bhutan, this led to a different view on the purpose of development, which for them is not maximizing economic growth or maximizing income, but, well, maximizing happiness, or at least improving living conditions for the sake of allowing people to lead happier lives rather than the wealthiest possible lives.
And this, you say, was possible because Bhutan was never colonized. So they weren't influenced by another country's economic structure. Why is that important?
Yes, so it is true. So Bhutan, maybe I should probably also say where it is, because it's a really tiny country that few people know about. It's a very small country with a population of less than 1 million in the Himalayas between India and China. First of all, yes, they were so never under the dominion of any other greater power. So they were never confronted, you know, with a power that imposed in another culture, another way of doing things upon them. And also, I think, and it's probably most important, they retained a certain pride and self-confidence in that they are able to manage their own affairs and their own destiny.
I understand that you actually did some research in Bhutan, part of your dissertation.
Yeah.
What were you able to find out during your time there? Was there any one particular case that is remarkable or memorable to you?
Yes. So my interest in going to Bhutan was to understand better what difference that makes, or their choice and their gross national happiness concept made to policies and to everyday life in Bhutan. And I mean, obviously, it's not that everything's different. It's also not that, you know, everybody's happy or they don't have the same kind of conflicts and difficulties than other countries. But I do think that they think about these questions of development and poverty in a different way. So what is remarkable is when you look at how politicians talk and at their speeches, they feel compelled to justify all of their, you know, political programs and decisions in terms of how that helps people lead happier lives. In most other countries, politicians would find it sufficient to say, well, we'll do this because this will help us grow our economy faster. But in Bhutan, people will usually demand that, well, but how does this economic growth help us lead happier lives?
In your PhD dissertation, you argue that happiness should not be the primary objective of governments. Why not?
Right. So I think that happiness is very important, and it's very good to think and talk about it and discuss the effect of certain policies on happiness, but it shouldn't be the ultimate yardstick, because if you really think that through, that means that you are willing to override considerations of justice and human rights.
If it shouldn't be the primary objective, what is its role in economic policy?
I see its main role in helping us see through the purposes of the decisions we take, because I think often we stop short in our arguments when, for example, we see, well, this is good for our economy or, you know, for economic growth. And few people really question, well, is this really then good just because it's good for the economy? And thinking about happiness helps us go one step further and say, okay, so this is good for economic growth. So it's probably likely that this will increase happiness, but we should really try to walk this through and spell it out. What does it really mean? And you know, I think in many cases, things that increase economic growth can not be in the best interest of increasing our happiness. Once we understand that, we are in a much better position to really take good decisions, even though it's not the only information that we need. We need more information than just how will this affect happiness. The real value of just talking about happiness is really in bringing our debate onto a higher level of reflection. And governments should certainly not, you know, try to make people marry early because some study shows that that makes people happier.
You don't think that a government should decide what is happiness? That does that take away freedom of choice for the people who are being exposed to it?
There's this frequent objection that as soon as policy and the government starts worrying about happiness, it will intrude into people's lives. So first of all, I agree that this should not be the point, and governments shouldn't think about happiness that way. But governments have to think about something, right? And decisions of governments should reflect what the public wants.
Johannes, as an economist yourself, any thoughts or projections about Evansville in the time you've been here?
I really have made great experiences in my family. I think Evansville is, it's very similar in size, in terms of population size, to Osnabrück. And I think the same in when I'm at home in Germany, that this, it's still a size of a city where you can know a lot of people, where you can just bump into people. And I just love that. And the fact that, you know, it's not so anonymous, and people, I think, are just friendlier than in very large cities. You know, people have a very positive attitude, I think.
Well, I am so glad that you stopped here in Evansville and that you could come on the program. Thank you, Johannes.
Thank you.
That was Johannes Herrada, a visiting professor from Osnabrück, Germany. He's here at USI for just a few more weeks. And in that conversation, he mentioned Bhutan and their gross national happiness. But another conversation I had with him later on, he mentioned a mayor in a small town in Germany who, same situation, Bhutan, every decision she made was, you know, she used happiness as her compass, as, well, are we going to support this project? Will happiness be the ultimate outcome? And this approach, of course, is met with a lot of resentment because, as we've learned, happiness involves a certain degree of free will. So, and that got me thinking, how does Evansville's government understand happiness in the context of development? Is that a word that even gets brought into their conversations? So I thought, well, I will talk to Philip Hooper, the director of the Department of Metropolitan Development here. As you know, there have been many projects going on in Evansville, and it sounds like many more ahead. So let's find out how much they talk about happiness back in their offices. Here's my interview with Philip Hooper. I'm joined by Philip Hooper, the executive director for the Department of Metropolitan Development, and I've brought him here in on today's conversation about happiness and its possible correlation to economic development, because, well, we've had a couple projects this past year that I think warrant some more conversation. I'm thinking in particular about the Convention Hotel, but more about that later.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here, Philip. The primary interview that's framing the structure of this program was with an economist whose primary research is looking at happiness and economic development. And he agrees, yeah, there is a correlation. That's why Western societies, United States, Western Europe, are happier than other countries, but to a point, you know, at some point, more income, more capitalism isn't going to improve your happiness, but there is a correlation. And one community he looks at in particular is in Germany, a small town in Germany where the mayor, every decision she makes is defined by, okay, will this investment bring long-term happiness for the community? That's kind of the compass she uses in making a development decision. So I wanted to hear from you and the Department of Metropolitan Development, how much of your decisions when deciding on a development project, particularly one with public funds, how much do you consider happiness, if at all?
You know, I don't think you'll find anywhere in writing where happiness is on a matrix of decision-making. But I think you can look to our recent work for our Jacobsville redevelopment area. And in Jacobsville is a great example of really the second quality of life, kind of comprehensive community development effort in Evansville. The Glenwood neighborhood went through a very comprehensive community development effort in partnership with Habitat for Humanity. And Jacobsville is going through a comprehensive community development effort, a quality of life planning effort. And the quality of life planning process, very much, while it may not say this is like a happiness planning project, by virtue of it painstakingly reaching out to new resident leadership and listening to residents in a specific area, is very much in line with some of the recent writings and really more decades of a body of work that suggests socially, psychologically, anthropologically that happiness is important, and the way that our communities grow and are built and are designed, whether or not it can encourage or limit those chance encounters with neighbors, is important for a sense of community. You know, one way to look at happiness is people who can walk to things from where they live tend to be happier.
So, mm-hmm. So would you say then that quality of life is loosely that that variable measuring happiness, or that's the term that development chooses to use?
I would say that that's the closest thing here in Evansville and in the state that I'm aware of. The Indiana Association for Community Economic Development are great leaders, really nationwide, not just in the state of Indiana, nationwide for comprehensive community development practices. The city of St. Louis, Missouri has a consulting agreement with IACED for them to come from Indiana, skip Illinois, come to Missouri, St. Louis, to help them with a neighborhood comprehensive development strategy as well. So that's a really great body of expertise we have here within our state. And while they may not have happiness, gross national happiness products that they measure, certainly quality of life planning is very synergistic with that.
Well, something that this program is kind of hash out is whether generations, and The Economist agrees with this, generations have different understandings of happiness. And I'm thinking particularly in terms of kind of the suburban sprawl here in Evansville. And you've made it a priority to bring that development back downtown. And so I wonder, is that part of different notions of happiness or what quality of life is? You said walkability.
I think there are generational differences with regard to what makes people happy. I think that's one of the defining differences between Generation Xers and Millennials versus Baby Boomers. The cultural shifts that have taken place and some of the reaction to a mode of planning that really gets away from the traditional form that cities have taken. And we've learned lessons about, you know, how the lack of sidewalks and automobile dependency really isolate segments of society. If you don't have access to a car because you're younger than 16, or for whatever reason you cannot drive, or you've lost the ability to be able to, or have never had the physical ability to operate a vehicle, you're very isolated, and that's not good for community. You know, I think it's largely a huge part of what makes downtown such a compelling site for the medical school. I will absolutely contend until the decision is done, and we look confidently forward to that decision, that it's important for the consortium of schools making up the medical school that it be downtown. It's not necessarily downtown will benefit from this. It will, but I wholeheartedly believe that the students and faculty at a downtown campus will be happier. You may have a campus proposal that you may feel, oh my goodness, they have, 100 acres optioned. Well, that's fine. Students can walk 2 miles to campus and be isolated from things that make them happy. Or you have our campus, which really includes $1 billion of existing investment and things that are built in that we think will make not only, the happiest students and faculty, but will prepare students for the real world where all ranges of clients can make it to the campus via its access to public transportation and access to being close enough to walk to the facilities at the campus.
That was medical school wasn't something I thought would be brought up today. But while we're on that, what about concerns that, IU said, well, we're not in the business of downtown development. How is the city working to make that more appealing to IU?
Well, they're not in the business of suburban sprawl development either. They're in the business of making an environment for successful training and education. And we will show that the most successful environment for that will be downtown.
Interesting. So you see a correlation between possibly a medical school downtown and happiness in this community?
Absolutely. I absolutely think that the programs that the universities offer will be more successful downtown because it's in the community that students need to be versed in if they're going to be the most competitive job seekers. They will interview better for their jobs in the future if they have trained at a campus that intersects them with the entire community seamlessly versus a location that really isolates folks that don't have access to automobile transit. And when you get a job, you're happy.
And education statistically makes you happier.
You You're with The Trend here on 88.3 WNIN and online at WNIN.org. Stay with us for the final segment when Cass Harrington talks with two Henderson residents with two generational takes on happiness. And also, we'll head back to our conversation with Philip Hooper. That's all trending today on 88.3 WNIN FM, where support comes from Rabin Tire and Auto Service, a proud sponsor of WNIN programming. Rabin offers a selection of tire brands, including Michelin and Goodyear, along with complete auto service and recommended maintenance by trained technicians. Information on the web at RabinTire.com.
As the executive director of the Department of Metropolitan Development, you have your notions of happiness, what will improve the quality of life in this community. How do you move forward with a project and consider how to make everyone happy if everyone kind of has their own determining factor or idea of what that looks like?
Well, at some level, when you say make everyone happy, there's also a concern that comes up, the image of the Joker at the end of Batman maniacally throwing money in the parade, you know, makes people happy. But we have to be strategic. And so if on one hand, there's a threat to saying, well, what makes people happy, as there's a threat to that being a driver for all that's, you know, bad about public policy and all that's bad about strategic decision making versus ad hoc decision making. But if you look at happiness in terms of quality of life, then absolutely that's something that we look at. At the end of the day, we realize that since the creation of the Housing Acts of 1974 that created the need for a Department of Metropolitan Development to work with the federal community development piece and to convene community development through the community development block grants, the home investment partnership grants that came on decades later, there aren't enough resources to solve every problem. And so from that perspective, we cannot make everyone happy because we don't have the resources to fix every problem. And so it brings in a very important conversation that's obviously a tough conversation, but in terms of where can you have the biggest bang for your buck, where ought resources be concentrated to have a lasting impact and to really connect access to wealth and access to employment and access to an environment where you can live in a house that is decent, that is attractive, that blends into the neighborhood, that has zero poverty stigma. Where can all those things most successfully come together?
You mentioned Haney's Corner, which is a pretty diverse part of town. And I wonder, you know, how would you apply that to a place like Haney's Corner, you know, in a democratic way that would take care of the needs of everyone in that community as best as possible, since it is so diverse economically, sociologically?
Well, I think we've applied it to Haney's Corner through a series of neighborhood engagement sessions where the Sustainable Evansville Area Coalition has engaged residents to plan for project prioritization in the area. And the Urban Living Center next to the Alhambra Theater are a series of, I think, the 10 prioritized ideas from the neighborhood that, similar to the 8 big ideas in the Jenkinsville Area Redevelopment Plan, the Sustainable Evansville Area Coalition Plan also had that. And then even as simply as when we used a federal neighborhood planning grant to go into Haney's Corner to have a conversation about the identity and history and potential logo that was developed with purpose design, that was a community conversation. That certainly wasn't just a designer making a logo that looked neat and cool on letterhead, but because we maybe didn't coin it like this, but we know that may not make everyone happy, right? So we had two community conversations broadly, and then our designer had several interviews with residents. There's a YouTube video that kind of documents that story and the progression of the what is now the logo for the neighborhood, the 4 neighborhoods coming together at Haney's Corner. We certainly didn't shy away from the identities of Goosetown and Culver and the Riverside Wheeler historic area and Blackfords Grove. And that was a part of that conversation. But I know that, you know, we're not always able to move fast enough to keep everyone happy. And sometimes that's a constant worry or a constant threat, is that we're simply not able to move quickly enough for everyone's liking. And sometimes that's a threat.
So whether or not happiness is a spoken term in your office, how much of it, spoken or unspoken, weighs in on decisions that you make, whether or not to support a project? Say you were presented a Ferris wheel downtown, or, you know, updating the sewage system. You know, how much would happiness, is that a factor at all when you decide on something?
Well, and sometimes, you know, it depends. The question I ask a lot is who's your funder? And if the EPA is our funder, the consent decree sewer work is probably going to win. And if the Wellburn Foundation is your funder, health and wellness probably will win. So in that case, maybe you're asking yourself, how can you make your funder happiest? And in our case, we work with a lot of HUD grants, and we certainly want to make HUD happy, so that when we need, when we have an ambiguous situation and we want a determination in our favor, we want them to say, yeah, we trust Evansville. They're really executing our goals. We're happy with Evansville.
And so you want to make the investors happy.
That's always true. And you can't forget that. And so whether it's a public-private partnership, you know, we've got to make the public happy with their investment. The developer needs to be happy with their investment. If you're working with the grant funds and you make your funder very unhappy, you may be off of the list for a long time for that funding source. So that, you know, that's a consideration always to be made.
Right. Well, Philip, thank you so much.
I was happy to talk to you.
That was me talking with Philip Hooper, the Executive Director of the Department for Metropolitan Development. And I'm Cass Harrington. We are in the final segment of The Trend. We first took a broad look at this conversation, happiness and economic development, starting with a conversation with an economist who has kind of a global perspective. And then we shifted gears and spoke with the local government to hear what's going on here in our community, Evansville. And then I thought we would zoom in on the lives of some local residents in Henderson. This is a conversation about happiness in the tri-state. So I'm joined here in the studio by Norris Priest, who is a Henderson resident and the owner and president of Vaughn Insurance. And he also owns a bed and breakfast, and he's a magician. He wears many hats in his community. But Norris, thank you for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you, Cass. It's good to be here.
Well, your life story intersects so many places in today's conversation. I couldn't help but smile. You know, Philip Hooper talked about the importance of walkability, of living in a community where you can walk and get around. And we heard about how moving to urban centers and people are simplifying their lives and so many different things that I thought you would be a great person to talk with. I understand you moved from the suburbs with your family to downtown Henderson, which is across the street from your bed and breakfast. Is that right?
Well, no, it's right next door.
Right next door.
Well, I might back up and say, yes, we lived in a subdivision, and the reason we lived there was because our sons, we wanted them to be as close to the schools as we could get them, and we bought this home in Highlander Acres, and they were able to walk to school. They graduated out of high school, and there was a home just 52 steps from where my office was downtown, and it was about to go on the market. I found out about it, and we bought it. And it took us about a year to get things all straightened up, new heating system. It was an older home, but a nice home and very comfortable home, which we really do enjoy living at. It has a full basement in it, and magic is a hobby of mine, and that's where my magic is, in that basement. But as I said, I'm only 52 steps from work, and there's a lot of days that my car never gets out of the garage.
Wow. Well, and so would you say that, you know, has your lifestyle been a little more optimistic since you've moved downtown, or has the experience been more positive?
It's not anymore. I have tried to be a positive and optimistic all my life. I learned as a young person that a happy person with a jovial attitude would get you a lot further than being the opposite. So I've really lived on the happy side of the line, just to be real truth with you. Life has been good to me, and I have a sweet wife. She's just precious. I don't know what I'd do without her. And two fine sons and two fine grandchildren, Callie and River. Oh. They're just precious.
And it's like from your experiences, it's as if you lived 1,000 lives. And I want to talk more about all the different jobs and places you've lived. But first, we're going to listen to a clip of Susan Vickers. She's also a Henderson resident. She lives in downtown Henderson as well, and she's a young mother. She used to work for hospice for almost a decade, and now she teaches part-time at USI. So let's listen to Susan and her take on happiness, and then we will hear more from Norris Priest.
What did you see in the Dominican Republic that really, I don't know, made that more mm-hmm. concrete for you?
Our son, named Henry Harris, is named after a little boy from Santiago. And he was a little boy who sold bananas outside of the factory where we worked. And he would come every day. Down in that area, school was only a half day because there was not enough schools, and they would go and shift to school. So he went to the afternoon school. So in the morning, he would come make a living selling fruit. And we just fell in love with him. He was the sweetest boy, and he was making a living for his family, and he was 8 years old. So we became very attached to him. We would, bring him things from home, and we would travel back and forth. We would take him kind of the necessities of clothing and underwear, and then we also took him like baseballs and baseball bats and gloves because he loved baseball. Well, back and forth, we would take him kind of the necessities of clothing and underwear. And then we also took him like baseballs and baseball bats and gloves because he loved baseball. And when we would take him new things from our perspective, he would come back and the bats, he would scratch them up so that they wouldn't look new. Because that meant if it was new, it meant it would have been probably stolen or taken away from him to be sold. Stuff didn't really matter to him as much as us just caring for him and loving on him every morning. So he really did. He changed our life. My husband would give him $1 every morning and wouldn't take a banana from it. He would just always give him change and dollars and would always say to him, "You should keep this and save this money so that you can, get the things that you need instead of giving it away or giving it to your family." And when we left there, Paris showed my husband the bag of dollar bills that he had saved.
Wow.
And so he really did. That little boy changed us. We chose to live more simply, I think, after we moved home.
Wow. And that's a testament to how, happiness just isn't stagnant. It changes through experience. And so you said when you came home, you wanted a simpler life. And I understand, so you grew up in the suburbs, and so now you live downtown. Is that mm-hmm. kind of almost representative of a trend where younger families are moving back into urban centers?
Yes, we have really kind of chosen to stay in the downtown part of Henderson because it is a more simple life. We walk, we have beautiful riverfront, and our kids get to ride their bikes in the middle of town and really learn that you can walk and buy a pair of shoes in downtown Henderson and walk back home. And I don't want to overstate. We get in our car and we drive to Walmart, of course.
Sure.
we have one foot in one world and one foot in the other, I guess. But we do. We love being downtown. We've talked about if we were to have to move away, we would want to be in the similar situation where we can live downtown and, be a part of a downtown community.
Anything else that I might have missed?
I think the last probably portion of my life that I've gone through in the last kind of 6 months is, as far as happiness is, you know, we came home and kind of got back into our careers and into the fast-paced life. And about 6 months ago, I actually kind of retired from full-time work to spend more time with our kids and doing things that really kind of mattered to us. And I think that has come full circle. I'm now teaching at USII and kind of giving back what I've learned in my career to the next generation. And I'm happier than I've ever been.
Oh, wow.
You know, you're right. Happiness is fleeting, and you have to really work to stay happy.
That was a big point that the economist brought up, is income is really a secondary factor when he was looking at his research. And one of the biggest primary factors in determining how happy a person is that leisure time and that free time.
Right. It was a huge step for us. I mean, we gave up half of our family income. And I was a manager and, you know, had a huge role in a local healthcare agency. And we decided just to take that step back. And we are all happier. Our children are much more well-adjusted, and my husband is much more, you know, less stressed. We've slowed back down again, and we're all much happier right now.
That was me talking with Susan Vickers, a mother and professor of social work at USI. She and her husband, Mike, live in downtown Henderson. And I'm here in the studio with Norris Priest. He is also a Henderson resident, but he has a different generational perspective. He is a self-proclaimed country boy. And before we heard that conversation with Susan, you said that, you know, your surroundings, whether downtown, suburbs, or country, hasn't really affected your happiness. You are overall quite a happy fellow.
Yes, and really, we live in the country downtown. We have deer come through our yard, animals all the time. I sit on our back porch and have breakfast in the morning. We eat all of our meals on this glassed-in porch looking over the Ohio River. It's a great experience. We have a great downtown Henderson. It's just a great town to live in.
Now, but you grew up on a tobacco farm, correct?
Well, we had cattle, corn. We'd had the whole gamut on the farm. And we still have the farm, by the way. And I enjoy going out there and piddling around, if I can, once or twice a week. Yeah.
Well, you know, in your early days as a first through 12th grader, you attended a small farm school in
Hibbardsville,
and you said you were poor, and everyone there was poor.
Yeah.
Were you still happy?
Well, I didn't know any difference. We were really rich and didn't know it. On the farm, we had food. We were never hungry. I'll have to tell you, my experience in the farm, though, was one that I didn't like, working in tobacco. And I told my father at a young age, if I ever get old enough to get out of this tobacco patch, you'll never get me back in it. I sort of meant what I said. And when I was a junior in high school and I was able to buy me an automobile, I went to town and I found me a job. And I went to work at a funeral home when I was in the junior and high school.
And that is so young.
Yeah,
to be in that kind of work environment.
I worked there, and I have not been without a full job since then. Oh. And I have been happy.
What was it like working in a funeral home at a young age? Did that at all affect, I don't know, your understanding of happiness or your grasp of it? Because I imagine that must have been.
I've always had an empathy for people who have problems and challenges. And death in a family is a challenge. And I felt like I could help people. And I guess that's what drew me to it. And I still have, I have the background to own and operate. I'm a licensed embalmer and funeral director. I'm happier the way I am. I'm in the insurance business. The insurance business has been good to me, and all the people of Henderson County have just been great to me. Really, really have. It's a great place to live.
Well, my last question is, and you are varied, and I mean, you have done so many interesting things. I mean, from working on a farm to working as an undertaker to owning an insurance company. Would you say that happiness in your life has been something that you've had to be committed to make that? Or is it what's going on situationally? Which has a greater effect, your life outside or what's going on internally?
Well, I found out early in life that you're happy when you live within your means. And I have always lived within my means. If I could not pay for it, I deprived myself of it. And I think that is one of the keys to life today, in being happy. I never will forget when my wife and I got married. We had envelopes that we kept our money in, and when we spent what we had for that, for food or entertainment and such, we did not spend any more. We learned to live within our means, and as a result, we have been rather happy our 55 years of married life, and I don't remember ever a financial problem between us. It's been a great experience, and I find life easy when you keep it simple.
Great. Well, I have really enjoyed having you here in the studio, and I look forward to visiting over in Henderson to see exactly how happiness is working over there. So, yeah. Thank you. That was Norris Priest, a resident of Henderson, the owner of L&N Bed and Breakfast, and the president of Vaughn Insurance Company. And we are at the end of today's trend. Happiness, as it turns out, is not something that is taken lightly around here. It's part of economic development strategies, and it's how we frame our lives. But as we've heard in today's conversation, happiness fluctuates, and economic policy isn't designed to please everyone. Therefore, economist Johannes Herrada said, it's important for political and economic leaders to use the word happiness more often to bring reflection and meaning to policymaking conversations. That's not the end of this conversation. You can hear this and more online at WNIN.org. You can also find songs you heard on today's program. The Trend is a production of WNIN in collaboration with the Evansville Courier and Press. This episode was produced by myself with help from Ryan Reynolds at the Courier and Press. My dear friend Tony Voss engineered today's live show, and the theme music was written by the talented Jeffrey Osman. I'm Cass Harrington. We'll talk next week. This is WNIN-FM, Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro.